On this February 18th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. An often contentious hearing by the House Financial Services Committee looking into the wild market swings involving stocks like GameStop with Robinhood, hedge fund managers, and others. Some pointed questions about what happened and what it means for investors. Also, it was announced today that top executives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter, they will testify next month before a House Energy and Commerce Committee, the hearing to look into the spread of online misinformation, including false claims involving coronavirus, as well as the results of the 2020 presidential election. That same committee also looking into why so many Texans lost power this past week involving an unusually powerful winter storm. There's also a sidebar story, this headline from the Dallas Morning News. Senator Ted Cruz insisting he was just being a good dad, taking his kids to Cancun, Mexico. The Republican lawmaker getting attacked on social media. He's back in Texas tonight, and we will talk to the Washington bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. And the divisions within the Republican Party becoming more evident. TheHill.com writing the following, quote, allies of former President Trump saying that he is determined to make life miserable for the Senate GOP leader, Mitch McConnell. This story shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with today's House Financial Services Committee hearing. 1 month after GameStop shares surged to a record level, the online brokerage firm Robinhood and Reddit facing probes by the Departments of Justice, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and both chambers of Congress. That investigation and some sharp questions on display today's congressional hearing. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the stock of the video game retailer shares soaring this last month to above $480 a share. Now keep in mind that was up from just $18.84 on January 2nd of 2021. The surge, fueled in part by an army of individual traders, they were buying shares and options and trying to squeeze out the hedge funds who were shorting the stock. Now, the episode has led to questions about the market's integrity. It's also set up, as you said just a moment ago, a series of federal investigations into market manipulation. Prosecutors have subpoenaed information from brokers like Robinhood, the online brokerage company that many individual investors used to trade GameStop, as well as other stocks. Among those testifying, Keith Gill. He is with the Chicago-based hedge fund Citadel LLC.
I'm happy to discuss with the committee my purchases of GameStop shares and my discussions of their fair value on social media. It is true that my investment in that company multiplied in value many times. For that, I feel enormously fortunate. I also believe the current price of the shares demonstrates that I've been right about the company. A few things I am not. I am not a cat. I am not an institutional investor, nor am I a hedge fund. I do not have clients, and I do not provide personalized investment advice for fees or commissions. I'm just an individual whose investment in GameStop and posts on social media were based upon my own research and analysis. I grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts. My family was not wealthy. My father was a truck driver and my mom a registered nurse. I was one of three kids and the first in my family to earn a four-year college degree when I graduated from Stonehill College in 2009. That was not a good time to be looking for a job. From 2010 to 2017, I worked at a few startup companies, but there were significant periods when I was unemployed. I took an interest in the stock market, and even though I had very little money, I used those times to educate myself and learn more about investing. In April 2019, after nearly 2 years unemployed, I accepted a marketing and financial education job at MassMutual. My wife Caroline and I were thrilled that I had an income and benefits. My job was to help develop financial education classes that advisors could present to prospective clients. I was not a stockbroker or a financial advisor. I did not talk to clients, and I did not recommend stocks for them to buy. Before and after I joined MassMutual, I studied and followed stocks. One of those was GameStop. In early June of 2019, the price of GameStop stock declined below what I thought was its fair value. I invested in GameStop in 2019 and 2020 because, as I studied the company, I became more and more confident in my analysis.
That from Keith Gill at today's hearing. By the way, GameStop closing today at $40.69 a share. One of the leading questions was there any collusion between the hedge fund companies and the online trading sites such as Robinhood? Here is Democratic Congressman Juan Vargas of California with questions to Ken Griffin. He is the co-chief investment officer and a majority owner of the investment firm Citadel.
From an outsider's perspective, you have the bullies, the hedge funds, and their armies of analysts and lawyers and regular old suits attacking the trust GameStop by shorting its stock. And then to rescue, here comes the retail investors, and they're taking stock to these incredible levels. And all of a sudden, Robinhood steps in, but not to help the little guy. He steps in and says, I'm going to help the big guy, and stops the sale because no one knows how high this is going to go. And who's getting it? Who's getting socked in this thing? The bullies are, the hedge funds. And that's why people were excited about this. But all of a sudden, Robinhood steps in and they say, no, you know, we had to do this because of other conditions. And my good friends, the Republicans, say it was government, really. It was, you know, because the government regulations forced them to do this. Well, that's not what the public thinks. The public thinks that there was collusion, that the big guys, all of you guys, were figuring out how to do this and ultimately come out ahead, as you always do. And it seems my colleagues on the other side want to help people. Now, Mr. Griffin, if I could just ask you the first question. How many people are in the room with you? You could just count how many people are in the room with you.
There are five people, including myself, in this room, sir, Congressman.
Thank you. So I don't think my colleagues need to help the CEOs or anybody else. They got plenty of help. Now, I have to ask this. You said that you didn't talk to anybody, Citadel Securities. Did anyone in your organization since January 1st contact Robinhood?
Are you asking if we've had contact with Robinhood?
With respect to GameStop and what we're obviously talking about.
So, Congressman, we offered to have my colleague who manages that relationship be here today instead. He has firsthand knowledge. We, of course, are talking to Robinhood routinely in the ordinary course of business. We manage a substantial portion of their order flow.
Well, I understand that, but did you talk to them about restricting or doing anything to prevent people from buying, not selling, but buying in GameStop? Anybody in your organization?
Let me be perfectly clear. Absolutely not.
So if we depose everyone in your organization, we will find that.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
With more in today's House Financial Services Committee hearing, we're joined on the phone Eliza Collins. She covers politics and Congress for The Wall Street Journal. Bottom line, what is the committee looking for?
So this is a rare moment of bipartisanship in at least having this hearing. Both sides agreed that they needed to look into what happened with the GameStop frenzy in late January. They agreed they wanted to hear from the people involved. But what's next is where I think we'll really start to see some division. And we've already been seeing it in the hearing. Republicans have been very quick to push back on any additional regulations. There's been a little bit of criticism on how things have been handled. But overall, they're pretty happy with the status quo and definitely don't want to see more regulations, whereas Democrats are really pushing for more regulations. They've been questioning pretty hard the hedge fund, the head of the hedge funds, the head of Robinhood, you know, the head of the big companies that have been involved in all of this.
Let's talk about some of the players that you write about at WSJ.com. And let me begin with Keith Gill. Who is he?
So Keith Gill is the one sort of regular person, quote unquote, involved in this hearing. He is someone who lives in Massachusetts, and he basically got made a lot of money, was very involved in GameStop, and then was on Reddit urging other people to get involved in trading with GameStop.
So let me turn to Steve Huffman, who is the CEO of Reddit. And first of all, what is Reddit?
So Reddit is an online community used for all sorts of things, but the reason it's being scrutinized is because amateur traders used it to basically talk about stock. They've used it long before, but this was, they basically egged each other on in buying GameStop and a handful of other stocks, and that pushed the GameStop price much higher. And so Steve Huffman has basically been asked, you know, about Reddit, about the community, about sort of what has been in place for people to use a place like Reddit to be involved in the stock market.
The other key player in all of this, Robinhood Markets, Inc. Vlad Tenev is the chief executive of that online brokerage firm. What is his background?
So Vlad Tenev is, I would argue, the person who's been taking the most heat from Democrats. Robinhood is a trading application that got a lot of criticism because it was the biggest name, though there were a handful of others, that temporarily paused trading, basically during this whole frenzy. And they said that it was basically because they did not have enough capital to back up their trades. They were able to be up and running, you know, the next day, but they took a lot of criticism, especially from Democrats who have said that it unfairly hurt these amateur traders. And so he's being asked a lot of questions about that by Democrats. There are actually some Republicans who have been critical about Robinhood's handling of all this, saying they needed to be more clear about what was going on. But Republicans overall have been less critical of Vlad.
We're talking with Eliza Collins of The Wall Street Journal. The other component in this issue, the hedge funds. Gabe Plotkin is the founder of Melvin Capital Management, LP. What did we hear from him today, and what is his background?
So this hedge fund was betting basically against GameStop. Gabe said that he didn't feel that GameStop, which is a brick-and-mortar store to buy games, basically had a big future because people can now buy games online. So they were betting against it. And so when the GameStop stocks surged, his firm lost billions of dollars. And so he was asked, has been asked basically in their involvement in why he was betting against it. You know, that he's less of a controversial figure than someone like Vlad because there wasn't a specific moment, but Democrats generally are more critical of hedge funds. So there have been a lot of questions about just his overall work and the overall work of Melvin Capital.
And one final point, today's hearing really just the beginning of what will likely be a series of investigations on a number of different fronts here in Washington.
Yes. So the chairwoman of the House Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, has already said that they plan to have additional hearings. We expect hearings in the Senate. Patrick McHenry, who is the top Republican on the committee, who did want a hearing but then was critical of who was called, has said, you know, this is a fact-finding mission. He's been critical that the people called today were sort of all over the place, so we could see him focusing on some aspect of this and trying to investigate it further. But this issue is not going away. This is something that, you know, Americans, it was a really big deal. And so I expect Congress to continue to investigate.
The story tonight at WSJ.com and in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal. Eliza Collins here in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, the Dow losing nearly 120 points. The NASDAQ was off by 100. The S&P down 17. Congressional Democrats today introducing a bill to remake the U.S. immigration system. It's called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, unveiled by Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, and California Democratic Representative Linda Sanchez. Among the highlights, it includes an 8-year pathway to citizenship for those people in the country unlawfully if they arrived by January 1st of this year. It would also lift hurdles for those workers to legally immigrate to the United States, as well as add financial resources to border screening and replace the word alien with non-citizen in law. Senator Menendez announcing details during a Zoom call earlier today.
Under the status quo, we still prevent family members from reuniting legally in the United States because of lengthy backlogs and delays. We still send graduates educated in our great universities back to their home countries instead of allowing them to drive innovation here in America. and we still make it too hard for companies to hire the workers they need to innovate and force American workers to compete with exploited, undocumented labor. That's why we today collectively are introducing the U.S. Citizenship Act in the Senate and the House, legislation that brings to life President Biden's plan to restore humanity and American values to our immigration system. It's our vision. It's our vision of what immigration reform should look like. And it's a bill we can all be proud of. It will modernize our system, offer a path to citizenship for hardworking people in our communities, reunite families, increase opportunities for legal immigration, and ensure America remains a powerhouse for innovation and a beacon of hope to refugees around the world. I can tell you, as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that I must say that beyond enhancing security and improving management of the southern border, our legislation also finally addresses the push factors, forcing so many families to flee Central America in the first place. Transnational crime, violence, corruption, poverty, lawlessness. The prior administration's naive fixation on the wall failed to alleviate these horrific conditions. We must address the underlying root causes driving migration and create safer processes for those in danger to apply for asylum. That's how we stop ourselves from winding up in the exact same place down the road. And that's what this bill does. Now, there are some in Congress, I'll say from both parties, who argue against going big on immigration reform. Some still believe the answer lies in blocking all legal channels of our immigration system until we get our house in order. Others say we should leave the bigger, tougher questions for another day, pursuing narrow reforms that nibble at the edges and leave millions of people behind. Personally, I couldn't disagree more with both approaches.
That from Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The bill does have the support of President Biden, issuing a statement earlier today available on the White House website. And CBS News White House correspondent Nancy Cordes with this question to Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Hi, Jen. How are you? Thank you for doing this remotely. My first question is about the immigration bill. And I know you addressed this a little bit yesterday, but what's the White House take on the pros and cons of passing parts of the immigration plan instead of doing it in one fell swoop? A number of these congressional Democrats seem to be very open to the possibility of doing it in a piecemeal fashion.
Sure. Well, first, the bill being introduced today represents much of President Biden's vision, which includes addressing some key components of what he feels needs to be modernized in our system, including providing an earned path to citizenship, which includes, of course, Dreamers, responsibly and effectively managing our borders, investing in smart security, and addressing the root causes of migration from Central America. He feels each of these components are vital and imperative to address our outdated immigration system. Now, he also, having served in the Senate for 36 years, is no stranger to the process of a bill becoming a law, and he is looking forward to working directly with members, hopefully both parties. Immigration reform is not historically been a Democratic or Republican issue, to determine what the path forward looks like. And he is very familiar with the fact that a bill proposed does typically not look like the final bill signed, but it is just being formally proposed today. We are eager to work with Democrats, Republicans, members of the CHC, others who have been working passionately on these issues for a long period of time. At this point, he's just looking forward to having a bill to sign at his desk.
That from today's White House briefing, which was on the telephone because of this morning's ice storm in our nation's capital. And a final note on the immigration debate. Look for a series of House and Senate hearings in the coming months. We, of course, will be covering them on the C-SPAN networks. And now let's turn to the weather. Residents in Texas and elsewhere in the South continue to deal with frigid temperatures, snow, and in many areas, ice. This from KHOU-TV in Houston.
More freezing temperatures heading our way. Addison. Yeah, Sherman, unfortunately, we got one more round of winter weather to deal with before we get the chance to thaw out as we head into the weekend. And that's why we still have a winter storm warning up in effect through the latest 6 a.m. coming on up for tomorrow morning. Icy coating on trees and power lines, especially north and west of Harris County, and a refreezing likely everywhere due to standing water coming around along with those temperatures starting to go back down towards the freezing point. We have the area of low pressure responsible for the action going on right now across the area, skirting off down to the south. We still have rain showers, a little wintry mix here in several spots, but we are seeing an end to that current amount of rain shower activity out there towards the west. But as you look at the bigger picture, there is another feature that we are keeping our eyes on, and it's this cold front we can see right there in the water vapor imagery loop that will come sliding on down, squeezing the last little bit of moisture left in the system and giving us that final round of winter weather.
That from KHOU-TV in Houston, and the weather that Texans are not used to, even in February. But in the last 24 hours, progress has been made in restoring power to millions who had lost power in the previous 24 to 48 hours. President Biden has declared a state of emergency to provide federal assistance. Liz Sherwood-Randall is a Homeland Security advisor to President Biden.
In terms of, can you give us a rundown of the resources that FEMA has sent to Texas, you know, the number of generators, the number of meals, any sort of data you have on that? And then sure. To your point about hardening the grid, what role does the federal government have in making the Texas grid more resilient, given that it is largely separate from federal oversight?
Let me start with FEMA. The update I have from FEMA this morning for what it has provided to Texas is, as I noted, it has moved water, blankets, shelf-stable meals, and generators and fuel to help respond to this event. Specifically in Texas, it has made 60 generators and fuel available to support critical sites like hospitals and water facilities. It has moved in 729,000 liters of water, more than 10,000 wool blankets, 50,000 cotton blankets, and 225,000 meals. And it's also deploying additional capabilities as we speak, trying to be postured for additional demands that Texas may place and additional requests that Texas may express to FEMA for needs that FEMA can respond to. So, for example, trying to figure out how to get more fuel oil and diesel oil in, if necessary, to power facilities in this emergency. To the question about the Texas grid, you're right, the Texas grid is islanded. That is a deliberate decision that was made by Texas. But I do think going forward there's an important conversation to be had around how we can enhance the resilience of our critical infrastructure to meet the needs of all our citizens. For now, we're focused obviously on these days. The future will give us an opportunity to conduct that discussion at the federal, state, and local level. Thanks.
From today's telephone White House briefing, that was Liz Sherwood-Randall. She is a senior advisor focusing on Homeland Security to President Biden. Meanwhile, the House Energy and Commerce Committee is expected to investigate the causes of the widespread power outages across Texas and those questions over its electric grid. The announcement today from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
And speaking of inclement weather, our hearts and prayers go out to the people of Texas for what they are suffering in their situation there in terms of lack of water, lack of energy. I have a daughter in Houston, so I know firsthand what her concerns are, but her concerns are minor compared to people truly in need. To lose water and service for my family is one thing, but for people who don't have so many options, it's just heartbreaking. I would hope that the public policy of the state would recognize the needs that are there. We have in our COVID bill $50 billion for FEMA. The president has responded to the call for disaster assistance. He did that on Sunday morning. Now FEMA will take a measure of what the needs are. We want to be sure to have the funds there. There are other needs that my colleagues from Texas have told us about, needs that relate to nutrition. Again, the fact that some people were hopeful of getting their vaccine shot, are not able to do it. And it is So they want immediate assistance from FEMA to replenish Texas water supply and help Texas obtain safe and drinkable water. Immediate assistance from FEMA to respond to Texans for emergency personal assistance through direct payments and home repair assistance.
That from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi during her regular Thursday briefing. And late this afternoon, we talked to Todd Gilman. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. I asked him to explain the Texas electric grid system and why it failed during this winter storm.
It goes back decades to when Texas utilities were pretty happy to avoid federal regulation. And so Texas has its own power grid, one of three major grids in the lower 48. And it pretty much is not connected to the other two grids. There are a couple of emergency connections, and there have been times during wartime when it has been connected and even occasionally shared power back and forth across the Mexican border. But for the most part, Texas has its own power grid. So that's the first important thing to understand, and it's not subject to the same federal regulations that the other power grids are because it is not interstate. About 10 years ago, there was a kind of a similar blizzard, and it was widely recognized that the power grid in Texas was not terribly well weatherized, and the federal regulators suggested, but of course didn't have the authority to do anything about it, that Texas do a better job of weatherizing. That didn't really happen. So gas transmission lines froze. Of course, compared to 10 years ago, there's a lot more wind turbine generation in Texas, although it's still a small fraction, about maybe 10 or 15% of the power that got knocked offline had to do with turbines that froze up. And this is a time of year, unlike the middle of the hot summer, when the Texas power grid is usually stressed. This time of year, although Texans use electricity for heating for the most part, it's a time when the power companies take some of their generators offline for maintenance. So kind of a perfect storm. I know that's kind of a trite way that everybody's been saying it lately, but a lot of factors went into this crisis. And at the peak of it, many millions of people were without power during one of the bitterest periods in Texas history. I mean, it was down close to zero in much of the state. And, you know, this is not Minnesota, where people are used to extremely cold weather.
Will there be a federal investigation? Does Washington have any role in this?
Well, there will certainly be congressional investigations. Speaker Pelosi announced today that there'll be some hearings about it, and it is widely recognized. Even some of the more states' rights-oriented conservatives from the Texas delegation agree that this is not okay, what happened. Whether they are going to be open to federal regulation or not is unclear. But there are certainly experts at the federal level, and there will be much scrutiny of what happened, what could have been done differently, whether the Texas independence, the grid independence is feasible going forward. So far, Texas officials who are highly critical of the entity, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, which has become kind of a strange name because it wasn't very reliable all week. There's been huge condemnation of ERCOT's handling of this, and there have been rolling blackouts. So even as power has been coming back on the last couple of days, and the number right now is down to about 400,000 customers without power across the state, which is a low point from in the past several days. But Texas officials, for the most part, are not keen to see the grid under federal regulation. So there'll be federal investigations, but whether that leads to federal regulation and integrating the Texas grid in with the federal grids, the other two major regional grids in the country, that seems unlikely. There would certainly be an enormous amount of resistance in Texas.
We are talking with Todd Gilman of the Dallas Morning News here in Washington. And while all of this was happening, Another headline involving Senator Ted Cruz, who at least last night was in Cancun, Mexico. Explain the story.
Well, it turned out that when you're a U.S. senator with pretty much universal name recognition and identification in your home state, when you go to your hometown airport in Houston, everybody recognizes you. And people started posting social media photos of, look at that, it's Ted Cruz on our flight from Houston to Cancun. The senator had not announced that he was going on vacation. Obviously, the Senate is on recess this week after the impeachment trial that ended Saturday. But with this enormous power crisis going on, and as of yesterday, when the flight left Houston, there were still about 4 million Texas customers without power in bitter cold. So this was seen as maybe a little politically tone deaf. Senator Cruz and his office remained silent until early Thursday afternoon. His office finally put out a statement saying that he was just being a good dad. His girls wanted to go on a little getaway during a school break. And then we got some video of Senator Cruz at the airport in Cancun Thursday afternoon, checking in for a flight back to Houston. They haven't fessed up as to whether he planned just one overnight out of the country all along, or if this was in response to what really was an incredible pile on social media. Texas Democrats, as they have many times before, called for him to resign. People were comparing him to Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake if they don't have bread. I saw actor Billy Baldwin, just to pick one example, said, oh, they don't have running water, let them eat snow. It has been, you know, Ted Cruz is a lightning rod. Many people are always on the lookout for reasons to tweak him, and he just handed everyone a doozy.
The story at DallasNews.com. Todd Gilman here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Sure thing.
And MSNBC posting video of Senator Cruz in Cancun, Mexico, before returning to Houston earlier today. As Todd Gilman mentioned just a moment ago, this is what Senator Cruz told reporters.
Well, Texas is going through horrific storms, and millions of Texans have lost power, have lost heat, and have been hurting. And our family was among them. We had no heat and no power. And yesterday, my daughters asked if they could take a trip with some friends, and Heidi and I agreed, so I flew down with them last night, dropped them off here, and now I'm headed back to Texas and back to continuing to work to try to get the power on. What's happening in Texas is unacceptable, and a lot of Texans are hurting.
And that with Senator Ted Cruz earlier today. You're listening to Washington Today. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen saying that any tax increases sought by the Biden administration to help pay for some of the big-ticket items would be introduced gradually. During an interview earlier today on CNBC, the Treasury Secretary adding that the proposed tax increases would likely come later in 2021 as part of a larger legislative package. You might remember during the campaign last year, then-candidate Joe Biden proposing to raise corporate taxes from the current rate of 21% to 28%. And in a newly published study by the New England Journal of Medicine, the two coronavirus vaccines developed by Pfizer and Moderna both appear to be highly effective against the more transmissible variant of the virus first detected in Great Britain. This is viewed as a potential boost to vaccination efforts around the globe. And by the way, we discuss these new variants with Dr. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota. He's the author of a book called Killer Germs, our guest this week on C-SPAN's podcast, The Weekly. You can check it out. In South Carolina earlier today, the state's governor signing a bill banning most abortions. Governor Henry McMaster saying it was one of his top priorities since he first took office more than 4 years ago. Planned Parenthood then immediately sued, effectively preventing the law from taking effect. It's called the South Carolina Fetal Heartbeat and Protection from Abortion Act. It is similar to abortion restriction laws in 12 states that have previously passed, but all of them remain tied up in the courts. Currently, federal law does take precedent over state law, which does allow abortion under that 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. Here is Governor McMaster.
Ladies and gentlemen, this step we take today was long in coming. and monumental in consequence. But our battles are not over. Yet I believe that the dawn of victory is upon us. I ask the citizens and I ask the General Assembly to send me a bill, send me the heartbeat bill, and I would sign it. And you have, and now I will.
From South Carolina earlier today with Governor Henry McMaster, supporters of restrictive abortion laws are trying to get the issue before the United States Supreme Court, with the hope that with three justices appointed by former President Trump, that the court would overturn Roe v. Wade. Again, that decision back in 1973, a landmark Supreme Court decision. In a 600-word statement issued earlier this week, former President Trump did not mince words on his feelings toward the Senate Republican leader. In referencing Senator McConnell, the former president wrote, quote, "Mitch is a dour, sullen, and unsmiling political hack, and if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again." That, of course, followed Senator McConnell's attacks on the Senate floor after last Saturday's impeachment vote, in which he voted to acquit while also putting the blame for that January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol squarely on Donald Trump. In a Washington Times story today, Alex Swoyer writes the following, quote, "Republican officials and operatives reminded the Trump wing of the GOP that the former president owes much of his legacy to the Senate Republican leader, insisting that the veteran Washington power broker should not be discarded for disloyalty to former President Donald Trump." We talked to her earlier today for some more background on what is happening among Senate Republicans.
Yeah, there seems to definitely be a disconnect where you see Senate Republican leadership wanting to move past the Trump era into the next phase of the Republican Party, and possibly find, you know, who the party can unite, both wings of the party can unite around heading into the next election cycle. It's interesting, the whole back and forth that we saw between Mitch McConnell's statement after the impeachment trial, basically saying that President Trump was morally responsible for the attack on January 6th. Then, of course, the president pushing back, criticizing McConnell on his looks, and basically calling for Senate GOP leadership to replace him as leader. I made some phone calls to talk to some Republican Party officials in Kentucky to kind of get a feel for a red state, a traditionally red state, reliably red, that supported President Trump and, of course, has Senator McConnell as their representative here in D.C. and hear what they made of the infighting between the two. And the response was interesting, given that it's a very Trump state, pro-Trump state. The sentiment I got from those that spoke to me was that they were more on the side of McConnell, given that he's the one that's in Washington. He's the one that still has power.
And what's interesting is former President Trump continued yesterday to go after Mitch McConnell on a number of fronts, whether on Fox News or Newsmax. And yet one of the former president's closest friends, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, coming to the defense of Senator McConnell.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think that Senator Graham and others are trying to do their best to unite the two, right, the two wings. They don't want to lose the Trump voters that Trump brought into the Republican Party. But they also do know and respect Senator McConnell in terms of how many years he's been in Washington. What you hear from a lot of people, whether they're Trump allies or not, they do recognize that without Mitch McConnell as leader, the one accomplishment that both McConnell and President Trump have repeatedly touted is the whole filling of the federal judiciary with conservative judges and justices. And that's something that, you know, if it wasn't for Mitch McConnell holding the one seat open after Justice Scalia's death, and then, of course, moving forward to confirm Justice Barrett, kind of pushing forward during the Kavanaugh confirmation. If it wasn't for him kind of writing that through the Senate, President Trump wouldn't have had those appointees. So I think that there's some sort of, among the people I spoke to, they all kind of recognize that the two men worked well together, at least while President Trump was in office. And they're hoping that there could be some way to reunite them, at least for the 2022 midterms, and then, of course, 2024.
We're talking with Alex Weyer of the Washington Times, but let me follow up on that point, because in the statement issued by former President Trump, he clearly indicated that he is going to play a role in the primaries, the Republican primaries for the 2022 Senate races, and, of course, so will Senator McConnell. Could they be at odds over candidates in key states that could determine control of the Senate?
I think as of right now that there's a possibility of that. Of course, when I talk to politicos in various states, they say, you know, if you're a Republican in a very red state who might, you know, buck the former president or any of his policies, that you could be in danger of facing a Trump primary challenger, for sure. But when you get into more purple states, that might not be where the former president wants to spend time and resources, given that you're going to see more moderate Republicans succeed there.
More details at WashingtonTimes.com. Alex Weyer, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And there's news this evening on former Senator Bob Dole announcing that he is dealing with yet another health issue. The longtime Kansas senator and 1996 Republican presidential candidate is battling lung cancer. In a statement, he said, quote, "Recently, I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. My first treatment will begin on Monday. While I certainly have some hurdles ahead, I also know that I join millions of Americans who face significant health challenges of their own." Bob Dole is now 97 years old. He is a World War II veteran, injured in combat while stationed in Italy. He represented Kansas in the House and later in the U.S. Senate from 1969 to 1996. He served as the Republican leader in the Senate for more than a decade. And Bob Dole was also President Ford's running mate back in 1976. In a Washington Post op-ed published last week, Vice President Kamala Harris writing the following, quote, "About 2.5 million women have lost their jobs or dropped out of the workforce during this pandemic. That's enough to fill 40 football stadiums. This mass exodus of women from the workforce is a national emergency, and it demands a national solution. Job loss, small business closings, and a lack of child care have created a perfect storm for women workers." So at the White House today, she addressed this issue.
"And I don't need to tell you all, time and again, women and families across the nation have benefited from your leadership. And without you, each one of you, we will not be able to get the American Rescue Plan across the finish line now, which is the point of our discussion today. In 1 year, the pandemic has put decades of the progress we've collectively made for women workers at risk. There are three main reasons for this, as we all know. First, job loss. About 2.5 million women have dropped out or have been forced out of the workforce during the pandemic. Many work in lower wage jobs, jobs that have been undervalued for far too long and underpaid for far too long. Second, small businesses are closing. Last February, around 5 million women were business owners, and 2 months later, by April, 1 in 4 had closed their doors. So my first week in office, I spoke with a group of small business owners, many of whom are women, and they talked about how tough it is right now to keep their businesses up and running while balancing all of their responsibilities at home. In fact, one woman, Caitlin James, held her newborn throughout our conversation, which was by Zoom, because of course she was juggling all of the demands that are her daily struggle, which brings me to the childcare crisis. Because this childcare crisis is a double-edged sword. As homes have become makeshift classrooms, many working women have been forced to cut their hours or leave their jobs entirely."
That's from Vice President Kamala Harris at the White House as the Biden administration continues to push for that $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. Well, during an interview this morning on MSNBC, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio again going after Governor Cuomo, calling him, quote, "a bully for seeking to try to stop criticism of his handling of the coronavirus death toll in nursing homes." In fact, the New York Daily News writing the following, "The brutal takedown of Governor Cuomo marking the latest crisis in the rocky relationship between the two most powerful men in New York." Here's Mayor de Blasio.
"Yeah, it's a sad thing to say, Mika, but that's classic Andrew Cuomo. A lot of people in New York State have received those phone calls. You know, the bullying is nothing new. I believe Ron Kim, and it's very, very sad. No public servant, no person who's telling the truth should be treated that way. But yeah, that the threats, the belittling, the demand that someone change their statement right that moment, many, many times. I've heard that, and I know a lot of other people in this state have heard that.
So you believe Assemblyman Kim, that he was threatened?
100%. It's first of all, I know him. He's a good public servant. I've always seen him as a person of integrity, but it's just the script is exactly what a lot of us have heard before. It's not a surprise. It's sad. It's not the way people should be treated. And, you know, a lot of people get intimidated by that. I give him credit for not being intimidated.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the DOJ investigation. I'm sure some of these deaths involve people in the city. How concerned are you about the DOJ investigation? And do you believe they need to conduct an aggressive investigation because of things that you have seen?
Yeah, Joe, we need a full investigation, unquestionably. This is about thousands of people's lives. This is about our elders, and there are families right now in New York State that lost a grandma, a grandpa, they lost an aunt or uncle. They're not sure what happened here. They worry that something was done wrong. And the big question, how do we make sure it never happens again? This really hasn't been investigated. The truth hasn't come out yet, and we need it. We need it. These are people's lives. And the notion that information was held back for, you know, political convenience instead of the blunt truth coming out so we could save lives, something's profoundly wrong there.
And the state attorney general, as you know, Mr. Mayor, is looking into that.
That from this morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe and Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York. And by the way, the Brooklyn U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI are investigating the Cuomo administration's handling of those nursing home deaths across New York State. Well, earlier today, NASA's rover Perseverance landing safely on Mars to begin a mission to search for signs of past Martian life and to also obtain samples of soil and rock that could someday be brought back to Earth for study. Cheers, clapping, and fist pumping erupted in the control room of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life. At this point, the descent stage has flown away to safe distance. Perseverance is continuing to transmit direct through Mars upon its orbiter to Earth.
The excitement and celebration from NASA scientists and engineers, the landing on the terrain of the planet Mars, being viewed as the most hazardous phase of what is a multi-billion-dollar mission. Now, the rover did produce two low-resolution images of the landing site. We expect to see higher-resolution images from the rover. They should be available sometime tomorrow. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. All of our coverage online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington for the Thursday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we take your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Friday morning, Washington Post reporter Maria Sacchetti discusses a plan for immigration unveiled by congressional Democrats. And then former chair of the 9/11 Commission and former New Jersey Governor Tom Kaine discusses calls for an independent commission to review the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol. And reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan with John Sopko, Afghanistan's Special Inspector General. Also, Ben & Jerry's co-founders Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield join us to discuss their police reform efforts. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal live at 7 Eastern Friday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, texts, and tweets.